industries have become such a popular...
Just a reminder, today's conference is being recorded.
So the question is sort of what explains why registries have become such a popular crime-fighting tactic? And the answer is something that will be familiar to people who've worked on criminal justice issues and other criminal justice issues. Like the war on drugs, like what we're currently seeing with immigration, our responses to sexual offending have been largely influenced by the media. Coverage of sexual offenses increased 123% during a time when sexual offending itself actually decreased. And we know that legislators, policymakers, were directly influenced by this media coverage. There's a study out of Illinois that says that where lawmakers are quoted as saying that, yeah, these media coverages and the public outcry that resulted as after the media put a tremendous amount of pressure on them to kind of get tough on sexual offending, even if these policies weren't grounded in research and data. So the Adam Walsh Act, which is the most recent piece of federal legislation to deal with registries, it's not the first. Congress passed the Wetterling Act in 1994, which requires states to maintain a list of individuals convicted of violent sex against children and to register with the police for a period of 10 years. Megan's Law amended this act and required community notification, and then the National Sex Offender Public Registry, which was passed by Congress in 2003, creates a single national registry and makes failure to register a felony. And now we're on to the Adam Walsh Act, and I'll explain the details of that law in the next slide. So we saw in the previous slides that the federal government has been in the business of legislating around registries for years, but the Adam Walsh Act goes much further than any of the previous laws. The Adam Walsh Act mandates registration for children over the age of 14 who are convicted of certain offenses. And when you think about it, that provision in and of itself reflects some extraordinary backsliding, especially when you consider the advances in juvenile justice, the number of states that are recognizing the folly of treating children as adults, the evidence, the emphasis on evidence-based practices and promising practices. It's incredible that given this moment that we are in juvenile justice, where the Supreme Court has said that kids are categorically less culpable, that we have this federal law that's saying, you know, hey, states, you cannot treat kids different than adults. You can't make any distinction. So in addition to putting kids on public registries, sometimes for the rest of their lives, the Adam Walsh Act incorporates additional offenses that adults must register for. So essentially, any offense that's a sex offense under state law, you're going to have to register for some period of time under the Adam Walsh Act. The periods of time may vary, but if it's a sex offense under state law, you're going to have to register. The law also makes the registry retroactive and requires a state offense for failure to register. So as you can tell by the description of this statute, the Adam Walsh Act is going to affect the lives of thousands of Americans. It's going to require a huge investment in law enforcement resources. So what prompted Congress to pass this legislation? What did they rely on? Well, JPI researchers examined the congressional record and found that Congress passed this bill by relying on a lot of misinformation about people who commit sex offenses, about the nature of sexual offending in kids, and about best practices for preventing sexual violence. Despite some of the rhetoric that Congress heard during the hearings on this bill, people convicted of sex offenses are among the least likely to reoffend, and children who commit sex offenses are very different from adult offenders in a number of ways, including the motivation for offending, and also their prospects for rehabilitation. And, you know, as I said in the beginning, this is a really uncomfortable topic. And I think Congress skipped over one of the scariest and perhaps one of the most sort of unspeakable things about sex offending, and that is that children are more likely to be sexually assaulted by a family member or a family friend than some stranger on the street. And stranger danger was vastly overhyped by Congress and by the advocates of this bill in an attempt to get it passed. And there really wasn't conversation about what happens in families, amongst friends, that sort of thing. So Adam Walsh, the act was not only based on faulty data, but it will cost states a tremendous amount of money to implement. You can see on your PowerPoint that it's $500,000 in Ohio, $12 million in Virginia. Given these times of economic crisis, it's critically important that states consider the fiscal implications of the Adam Walsh Act. There's a strong argument to get states to seriously consider implementation. And at the end of your PowerPoint, there's a link to JPI's report and also our briefing book. And both documents have calculated the cost of compliance in your individual states. And that analysis was based on the Virginia, the formula that Virginia used to calculate their cost. But it will give you a rough estimate of how much your state would have to shell out in order to comply with the law. And I should say here that the SMART office has recently announced that there will be some money available for compliance. It's a very little amount of money based on the overall cost of compliance, which include additional personnel, computers, those sorts of things. So even with the additional federal funds, the likelihood is that your state is still going to come out having to pay much more than it's going to get in order to comply with this law. In addition to the straight budgetary requirements of the Adam Walsh Act, there's a strong argument about the opportunity cost of compliance. When law enforcement officers must spend resources tracking and registering children and people convicted of nonviolent offenses, those are resources that can't be used on alternative law enforcement strategies. We've seen this play out in other states when registries have expanded. In Texas, California, and Michigan, those states have demonstrated that expanding registries requires a significant amount of manpower. It also requires taxpayer resources in order to do it and to do it right. Given what we know about children, targeting them and their families for registration can lead to some results that I think can only be talked about as absurd. You've got kids as young as 6 who are being sexualized for expressing affectionate behavior with their peers. Also, we know, and those of us who work with teenagers know this well, that 3/4 of all young teenagers are having sex, self-report that they are having sex, yet that act in many states is criminalized. And finally, what the mental health researchers and medical professionals are telling us is that when a youth acts out sexually with his or her peers, it's not necessarily predatory behavior. A lot of it is exploratory, and some of it may be issues of boundaries, but it's not considered the same sort of predatory behavior that some researchers have documented in adults. The other thing we know about kids who commit sex offenses is that their recidivism rates are very low. Recidivism rates for kids involved in the juvenile justice system vary. There's data that's around 55% to 85% in terms of recidivism. But kids convicted of sex offenses, the recidivism rates are closer to 18%. These kids have very low rates of committing the same sort of crime again, the same sort of sexual crime again. So that suggests that a registry is not the tool to help these kids turn their lives around. The consequences of being on a public registry mean that a child's church, school, and recreational activities will be notified. And that means that a child will have to disconnect from the things that are most likely to help him or her grow into a healthy adult. This can prevent, and this can definitely prevent access to treatment. The other issue is that because so much sex offending, so much offending happens inside families, there's likely to be a reduction in reporting when people learn about the grave consequences of offending. And I suspect that there will also be attempts for kids to plead down to non-sexual offenses to avoid the consequences of registering, and so that parents and families may not be able to get their kids the help they need because they want to try to protect their kids from having these consequences of lifetime registration or any sort of registration. And it's hard to think of a population that's been more stigmatized, perhaps more detested than the population we think of as sex offenders. And that is borne out in the data. You know, when a child is on the registry, it's not just the child, it's the entire family. And families have reported that as a result of having their homes listed on the registry, they're subject to being harassed and threatened. And the other thing that's been well documented is the sort of decreased reporting that I talked about before, that when there's interfamilial offending, that families just don't seek help because they're worried about the consequences, the sort of very public consequences of being on the registry. You know, the Adam Walsh Act undermines the very purpose of the juvenile justice system. It treats kids as adults, it ignores children's prospects for rehabilitation, and it ignores the research, the very compelling research that proves that kids who are connected to their communities, kids that can engage with their schools, with their churches, with other sorts of activities, are far likely, have a far less chance of reoffending than kids who are kept on the outside of these things. So these are things that we know that states have embraced and are trying to build their juvenile justice systems around these principles, but adherence to the Adam Walsh Act won't allow that to happen. Another way that registries miss their mark is by ignoring that people who are convicted of sex offenses and who are on a registry are not proven to be those who are most likely to reoffend. Registries, therefore, divert law enforcement resources from programs that are proven to help communities deal with sexual violence and are both over and under inclusive in terms of the focus on these people who've been convicted and who are now on this public registry. Registries also create a sense of false security. Based on what we know about sexual offending, keeping your child away from a registered sex offender is not going to necessarily keep him or her safe. We also know that registries are inaccurate, that even with all the resources that registries suck up, it's very difficult for law enforcement officials to keep them current and to keep them updated. And so there's questions about there's questions about the accuracy of the registries, number one, but even if you had a perfect registry, it's fairly clear from the research that a registry alone or that a registry is not going to reduce sexual violence in communities, sexual offending in communities. Another important fact about registries in the Adam Walsh Act and what I think a lot of states may be dealing with during the 2009 session is the slippery slope that the registry is going to create for lawmakers. Lawmakers are going to be under a lot of political pressure to look tough on this population. Once these code sections get opened up, once your state starts looking at how to comply with the Adam Walsh Act, they're going to be encouraged by the federal government, or at least they were in this previous administration, to look at the Adam Walsh Act as a floor and not a ceiling, and as to go to be tougher than the Adam Walsh Act is. Now, currently, the Adam Walsh Act doesn't require registration for offenses like urinating in public if you're a child, but it's entirely possible, and we've seen this happen in states, that when these code sections get opened up, the definition of sex offender gets expanded to include ludicrous offenses like public urination, like statutory rape, like adult-related prostitution offenses, and that once the state definition of sex offense is expanded, then Adam Walsh kicks in and is going to require some sort of registration. So that it's important to think of this bill in the context of your state statute and in the context of the political environment in your state legislature, and to really prepare for the sort of slippery slope of getting this code section open and the fact that this is a population that does not have a very strong political constituency. So the next two slides have to do with the recommendations for federal and state policy. And I won't go through each recommendation, but the bottom line here is that because there is so little federal money available for the Adam Walsh Act, states can forego compliance without having an overall adverse effect on their budget. And the questionable public safety consequences and the strain that the Adam Walsh Act would place on both families and law enforcement should help justify to states that they need to take a hard look at whether or not the Adam Walsh Act can fit into their framework of juvenile justice. If you look after the recommendations put pages, we have cut and pasted a table that talks about the status of each state in terms of compliance with the bill. And so you can look there and see, you know, at what place your state is at. And it's not enough for the states to pass their Adam Walsh Act compliant bill. They then must submit it to the SMART office in the Department of Justice, and that office must deem the bill compliant, and then the federal money will be released to the state. And for more information about this, for more information about the fiscal analysis, for information about some of the public policy arguments, as well as a briefing book that has some messaging, I encourage you to check out the JPI website, and we've got a link to the briefing book on the last page of the PowerPoint.
Yes, I'm here.
Ready to take questions if there are any.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Sheila, so much, and thank you, Amanda. I think that probably the easiest way to take questions would be if folks have questions, if they could just hit *6, and then you will be unmuted at that point, and you could ask your question. And if that gets too chaotic, we'll change our process. But I think that should work, and we'll have more direct access than me trying to mediate it through email. So if folks have questions for Sheila about her report or about what's happening in their state around sex offender registries or the Adam Walsh Act in particular, just press *6 and you'll be able to be heard.
Hello, this is Chris Molter from Wisconsin. And I don't see Wisconsin on your list of states. I was wondering if I'm missing it or...
This is Amanda. We actually took that chart from ASSA, the Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers. They've been doing a great job of keeping tally of what's going on in the states. If we don't have Wisconsin listed, it was because in September the last updates that I happened to record here weren't available.
Okay, and that would be correct. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Samadhi Jones with the Florida Department of Juvenile Justice. I have Jan Abey, what's your title again, Jan?
Management Analyst.
Who's a Senior Management Analyst and who's our in-house expert on compliance with the Adam Walsh Act and with juvenile sex offenses here for the Florida DJJ. And I just thought I'd let her speak.
The other thing I wanted to mention is that Florida did make a strong effort to limit the offenses as much as possible that would put a juvenile on the registry. And as a result, as of I-107, we've only put 49 juveniles up on the registry. And for most of you who know, Florida's got 20,000 kids on probation and 5,000 kids in residential placement. So I think that our communities did want to look at it in a fairly narrow way, and even some of those youth who in other states might have been, you know, have to register, we've tried to maintain that list is very small. I think one of the issues that we're seeing, and I'm not sure whether other states are seeing the same thing, is that we get even contradictory orders, ordering a child to register as a juvenile sex offender even though they were only 13 at the time of the offense. And we've ended up spending some time on trying to sort those cases out. So I think implementation has not been totally smooth.
Well, That's great to hear. And you know, we recognize that there are factors that that will result in states making a decision to comply. And I think a strategy to sort of keep this act, your compliance bill, narrow and to carve out the specific offenses that kids in the juvenile justice system will be required to register for is exactly the right strategy. So we're thrilled to hear that you had some success getting that through the legislature and were able to keep it narrow. And I think that your point about compliance is exactly what other states have seen when they've expanded their registry in other ways, is that it becomes, you know, charging and sentencing is an incredibly idiosyncratic thing, and that when you have these statewide, let alone national mandates, it becomes incredibly complex in trying to adhere to it and also to do it in a fair and constitutional way.
This is Sarah. Was Florida, did you submit that to the SMART office? Have you been, has the SMART office determined whether Florida is in compliance or not?
My understanding is that the Florida Department of Law Enforcement has not submitted their plan yet. Mm-hmm. Last year, during our legislative session, the bill that was to kind of bring us to phase two did not pass, primarily because of the concerns about the expense of building the system. Fortunately for us, our juvenile justice information system was pretty comprehensive already and fairly compatible with the system with FDLE, so our costs were not as high as they could have been. But once you implement all phases, we were talking a tremendous amount of additional cost. I was just curious, is anyone from FDLE on the call? I guess not.
I have a question here in Arizona. We've heard that our state has not opted into Adam Walsh at this point. However, we've heard of cases out there that are under appeal where even though the state did not opt into Adam Walsh, the federal government came in and charged people who weren't on the federal registry even though they only had a state sexual conviction, because they said that Adam Walsh under federal guidelines is a mandate. Have you heard of that?
No, I mean we have not heard of that, and you know the bill was passed under Congress's spending clause authorization, so it's, you know, basically the contract. If they comply, they get the money. So I'm surprised to hear that. I'm very surprised to hear that, given the way this bill was structured, which essentially allows states to opt out if they're willing to forego the funds. That's very disturbing.
That's how we felt.
I can imagine.
This is Mara Silver from the Public Defender Service in D.C., and I just had a question for you. We've been struggling a lot. We haven't, luckily, Adam Walsh has not come to bear here yet, but we imagine it will soon. And we've been struggling a lot trying to figure out guidelines for our trial attorneys in terms of, you know, proffers and pleas that are safe for juveniles, if that's what they're looking at doing, that would keep kids from having to register. And we've taken a look at the new 2008 guidelines, which it looks like sort of limit the offenses and the conduct that would require a juvenile to register. And I'm just curious if you've seen whether those guidelines have really taken effect. And our understanding is that the definition used to be, you know, and if the offense was equal to or you know, comparable to or more serious than federal aggravated sexual assault, a juvenile would be required to register, and that the 2008 guidelines limited that to, you know, more, they keep saying, you know, what's equivalent to rape or attempted rape and penetration. And I was just wondering if you guys have had experience with that and if you've sort of seen whether most states are adhering to the limitations in the new guidelines and just sort of how that's bearing out.
Yeah, I think the issues of the guidelines are so brand new, and that so many of the states who tried to get in compliance did so before the guidelines were issued.
Right.
And we're working off of the aggravated sexual abuse definition. And I think, you know, I think it's great to hear that Florida, I assume Florida was able to limit it to that definition. And in some of the other states, that I've done some work in were able to do that as well. I think that it's incredibly challenging because the federal code very doesn't match up with your state offenses.
Right.
So it's a real it's going to take a lot of strategy in terms of legislative drafting to make a decision about what you know, what offenses should be included. And I think that the important thing you know, that the communications from the SMART office have reiterated to the attorney generals in the states, this is a floor, not a ceiling. And I believe that's the exact language they've used. And so the key really is going to be to try to say, no, you don't want to go beyond the federal law if your state is dead set on complying, if your state or jurisdiction is dead set on complying.
Do you, if I could just follow up, do you have a sense of, you know, just, I guess, the 2008 additions aside, what, I guess, percentage or how many of the states are going beyond what's required in terms of the definition and making it more inclusive?
You know, I don't know off the top of my head.
And Sarah might be able to weigh in on this, too. I think we're going to know more when this legislative session comes up. It seems like there's a lot of states that were saying we're not going to make any movement until the guidelines come out. And we're hearing more and more that states aren't interested in complying. I think a surprising number are saying that this is going to cost too much. Vermont, for example, very recently, Virginia passed legislation that changes the statutes pertaining to sex offenses in the registry, but it certainly isn't compliance with the Adam Walsh Act. So I think after this legislative session in 2009, we're going to find out exactly what states are doing.
Yeah, Illinois also had some similar successes along those lines. And I do think, though, that in each of those states, that it was Ohio also was successful, it was a struggle, and that there were people who were, you know, there were sort of two sides, folks that were trying to push a sort of ceiling approach and folks who were trying to push the floor. And I think the cost, and I also think the movement in the juvenile justice field about, you know, promising practices, evidence-based approach, kids being different than adults, have really helped some of those legislatures move in the right direction, from my perspective, the right direction on this.
This is Jan Amy from Florida again. I think one of the issues that came up for us is kind of that thing of, if everybody doesn't comply, do we place ourselves kind of like, you know, will the whole house of cards fall if we don't have a majority of the states involved? And I think that we've kind of gotten caught a little bit, feeling like, well, we don't want to be in one of those states that are seen as a haven for sex offenders because we're not compliant.
Right.
Hi, this is Nicole Rensberg from Pennsylvania. We're kind of in that boat, and that we were kind of waiting because it goes against the premise of the juvenile justice system. And what we're hearing from our Juvenile Court Judges Commission, as well as our SAG group, is that they rather forego the $17 million in the Burns funds than to put the lives of kids in jeopardy. So I think we have been, you know, playing that waiting game. And, you know, we usually try to stay on the forefront of most of the juvenile justice things. But this is a real tenuous situation. And so we're waiting. That's the last that I've heard from about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, that's great news. Not surprising given all the great stuff you all are doing in Pennsylvania, but that's really great news.
It's great to hear
stakeholders that are willing to come out.
And you're talking about $17 million, which is a lot of money with the economy and what states are facing. But yet, when you stay true to the beliefs and the premise of the juvenile justice system, I think that speaks a lot. And, you know, the town hall meeting with Senator Greenleaf really caused him, I did some follow-up, to think about the laws that were passed in Pennsylvania that actually put kids where they are now. And we do have a civil commitment process, which is really interesting because it kind of went the opposite direction that we wanted it to go. And and those that were against it. I won't say that out loud, but, you know, but there is definitely ramifications that we're seeing that, you know, didn't the unintended consequences that were obviously verbalized, but people didn't think about. They did the knee-jerk reaction. And I simply think that, you know, this is what happened with the Adam Walsh Act. It was a knee-jerk reaction versus getting the people who were knowledgeable and that deal with this on a daily basis around the table.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
This is Arizona again. Can you hear me? I have a question regarding, whether there's been any action in terms of talking to anybody in Congress regarding repealing the section for youth under the age of 18, and if not, any discussion, well, I guess it's too early to say you have any discussion with the new administration regarding the guidelines, but what is the plan for that?
There's been some coalition building, I think, with NJJN, Sarah, of course, has been involved, ASA has been involved. I think we're slowly trying to come together, national groups, more local groups, who move toward repealing the Adam Walsh Act within the next couple of years. So far, we're sort of at a standstill as national groups. It's always, of course, a matter of who can house sort of effort, where the funds are, but the idea is on the table.
And NJJN and JPI collaborated to brief. To brief administration officials who are focusing on juvenile justice issues specifically on this and calling for a repeal of the provision that requires the registration of children. So it's I think we're all hopeful that we'll be able to at least begin to push this issue and test the waters on it.
Okay, thanks. The other thing I should just share is that Arizona did submit our current registry information to the SMART office, although I haven't seen a copy of it. My understanding is that we were denied being in compliance, but they gave us an extension to I think it's July of 2010 to comply. So I don't know whether that's happening in other states. But.
And states can get 2 one-year extensions as the law is written now.
Oh, okay.
So... that's something that you can request that your state ask for if you're busy educating folks about how to implement or not implement this act in a way that protects kids.
Well, then that makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There are other questions? Again, if you want to ask a question, just press *6.
This is Samadhi Jones. I'm with the communications office over at Florida DJJ, and I noticed that there was an article in a Texas newspaper just yesterday about pushback against the registry in which adults are starting to push back against being registered, and it was kind of juveniles were lumped into this news article. I'm just wondering how we can frame the messaging so that we are identified separately from that effort.
Yeah. I think that's a great question. And there's been some efforts around the country around residency restrictions for adults as well. And I agree with you that we have to present it. This Adam Walsh issue, if what we're focused on is the carve-out for kids, to focus on the kids are different messaging and to focus on the purpose of the juvenile justice system. And like our colleague from Pennsylvania talked about, a lot of our state legislatures have done some fairly impressive juvenile justice-related reform efforts. And now to be told by the federal government, well, actually, that doesn't count because we're going to tell you how to run your system, I think that those are some of the things that we can talk about and remind the lawmakers we're talking to that these are children.
Are there any further questions or comments?
Yes, this is Keith Monroe from Nevada. I was wondering, I came in late, and I was wondering if I could get some information on, maybe you've covered it, regarding carve-out for juveniles and still complying with Adam Walsh.
If you mean by carve-out, exempting children from the registration requirements, that would not comply with Adam Walsh. That the Act requires kids who are over the age of 14 to register for certain offenses.
And what I'm talking about is treating kids differently than adults.
Yes, even if a kid is adjudicated delinquent of a certain offense that's the equivalent of aggravated sexual abuse or rape, penetration, offenses that have those components, even if it's in the juvenile justice system, that child must still register according to the terms of the Adam Walsh Act. So there's no juvenile carve-out.
And I think the question was, if you do, when you implement, if the state implements the act and chooses to not put kids on the registry, not put juveniles on the registry, would the SMART office deem that in compliance? And I think that the SMART office has not deemed those states in compliance right now.
Yeah, that's my understanding as well, Sarah.
And I just want to clarify one thing that the loss of, or maybe Sheila, you could clarify, what is the precise loss of funding? Is it all of the burn grant money, or is it a portion of it?
10%. 10% of your burn grant money.
Are there any other questions, comments?
Yes, this is Jim Miller from Ohio. If a state is actually carves out or does not comply fully with the SMART office requirements regarding juveniles, can they still participate in terms of the National Registry?
I believe so. I think, and they actually just renamed the National Registry, too. I don't remember off the top of my head what it's called, but they just renamed it. I think the federal government is, well, currently, before Adam Walsh, the federal registry existed. They encouraged states to participate, so I would assume the federal government will take whatever state, regardless of their compliance status, whoever they want to put on that registry.
So, therefore, the only real consequence is 10% loss of burn money, correct?
We have time for one or two more questions.
Well, while people are thinking of questions, I'll just stress again that the 10% loss of the Burns funds needs to be considered next to the cost of implementation and all of the labor and the additional technology that would be required to be in full compliance with this act. And to stress that I think that sort of fiscal analysis will be critically important, especially in these times, for state legislatures to take a hard look at before they proceed with compliance.
Sheila, can you remind folks where to access the report, how they can get access to it?
Sure. If you look, we've got a link on the last page of the PowerPoint to our briefing book. And then if you go to, hold on, Amanda's thing.
Just if you go to our website, justicepolicy.org, the report's on the main page and the briefing book link is right under it. But as Sheila was saying, in the PowerPoint itself, on the last page, there's a link directly to the briefing book. It's justicepolicy.org.
And if anybody is interested in receiving copies of the briefing book or the report, we've got a limited number of copies that we suspect we'll be able to send out. So feel free to send us an email, and you can reach us through the website. we'd be happy to send out some copies of those materials for you.
Sarah, hi, it's Nicole again from Pennsylvania. Would it be possible to get a copy of that? We actually just had a staffer from Senator Spector's office come and speak to one of our groups in regards to Adam Walsh as well as the Second Chance Act. And he's willing to do whatever we need him to do in regards to this. I did stress some of the things that were discussed on the call today to him, and he's very willing to learn more. His name is Damien. I can't remember his last name. I don't have access to his card right now. But I think any information that we can deliver, and I will surely forward this link as well, will be helpful, at least on the behalf of all of us.
Absolutely. We'd love to support you in that effort, definitely.
I believe, and please do follow up with either me or Sheila, I believe there's actually a concerted effort to make sure that a number of policymakers and advocates get reports in Pennsylvania. But I have to follow up with our contact there about that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that would be fantastic. Thank you.
Sheila, I'm sorry. Can you give us your name and your direct contact information, like your email address?
Absolutely. Sheila Bedi, B-E-D-I, and my email address is S. D as in boy, E, D as in David, I, at justicepolicy.org.
Thank you.
And I'm going to have Amanda give her email address as well. She's another contact on this issue.
My name is Amanda Pettirudi, and my email is A, P like Peter, E-T-T-E-R-U-I, at justicepolicy.org.
Wait, can you say that again, please? I'm sorry.
Sure.
You were going in and out. That's all. I didn't hear it.
Sure. It's A-P-E-T-T-E-R-U-T-I.
Sure, I got that.
One other resource for folks to – well, two other resources. One is CJ, the Coalition for Juvenile Justice and National Juvenile Justice Network have a – Adam Walsh Act listserv, in which we periodically will disseminate reports and interesting articles and latest updates about what's happening with implementation of the act. And if you're interested in being on that listserv, you can email info@njjn.org, and I will add you to it. And I try to post new resources as they come up onto the NJJN website under our sex offender registry issue page. So that's another place to look for additional resources. Any other questions or comments before we close? If not, then thank you so much to Sheila and Amanda and everybody at Justice Policy Institute for putting together such a wonderful report and for taking your time to talk with us today. This is great, and it's such important information for folks in the field to hear. So I really appreciate you taking your time and talking with us. And
yes, thank you for your outreach to the greater good. We appreciate that as well.
Our pleasure. And thank you all for joining us on the call.
Thank you. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
Right. To join
Goodbye,
you all.
Everybody.